Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Dr. Soren Show, discussing health topics that matter to you. The views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Soren and his guests, and do not represent the views of Blue Sky Broadcasting. Consult your doctor before making any changes.
Everybody, welcome to the Dr. Soren Show today. I'm here with Vern Roof, who is a 47-year veteran of the firefighter, EMT, and now a commissioner in Ponderay County. Am I correct?
Ben, and you can actually, Doc, you can even throw in paramedic with that too. As a paramedic for 24 years.
So let's just jump into your history. I'm excited. Thank you so much for joining us. I am excited about learning more about safety and from your perspective as a firefighter, EMT, paramedic. So we got a lot of fun topics to talk about. So again, thank you for joining us.
Certainly.
And let's just jump in. Tell me a little bit about your experience and how you got into firefighting and EMT.
Well, you know, believe it or not, at the age of 14, I had a pretty good feeling that I wanted to be a firefighter and a paramedic. And my dad used to take me down to the fire station, and I was certainly too young to go out on calls at that point in time, but I went to the trainings, I helped clean the equipment, et cetera. And from that point forth, I just became more and more interested, became an EMT, that transitioned into paramedic, that transitioned into firefighter paramedic, that transitioned into captain paramedic. I had a very satisfying career. I felt that I really made the difference in quite a few circumstances. And I was lucky enough to retire with my health, and I came to North Idaho, and I became involved with the Northside Fire District as a volunteer firefighter. Mm-hmm. And I kind of did a second retirement after that, after 2 or 3 years, and then decided to cross off one list, one item on my bucket list, which was a politician. Please don't hate me for that. But I decided I wanted to try being a politician, so I became a fire commissioner, and I have 1 year left in my 4-year term.
So just out of curiosity on this last one, what is a fire commissioner? What do you specifically do?
Well, if you think of the fire commissioner, if you think of the fire department, the chief, the firefighters, the captains, they're more the operational aspect of the department, where a commissioner is more administrative. We're dealing more with the paperwork, we're dealing with the overall running of the operation from an administrative standpoint, whereas, you know, the guys that are the real heroes are the guys that are out there on the streets, the chiefs, the battalion chiefs, the firefighters, the captains. So we're kind of behind them, we're giving them whatever assistance they may need, and but once again, just an easy way to break those down would be we're administrative, they're operational. They're the ones that when you dial 911, you're going to see them.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. It's awesome that people like you that have all this experience can then help on the administrative end. You've paid your dues to climbing ladders and carrying heavy, you know, dragging people out of fire. So now you're doing the administrative end. And so your experience is very appreciated.
Well, I appreciate that. That's certainly a nice compliment.
So let's talk. What I'd like to do is just talk about specific things on safety, because as I've talked to you, we talked a little bit beforehand, and just talking to other firefighters, if there's one piece of advice that you could give people, what would it be as far as fire safety?
You know, we spoke about this before. I'm a very strong advocate of smoke detectors. Mm-hmm. Three of the most important components of fire safety: smoke detector, smoke detector, smoke detector. It's incredible, and it's deeply saddening and tragic to see just how many people perish every year in the United States for a lack of a smoke detector. Not only adults, but tragically children as well. It's all a tragedy. And just for the simple thing of having a $5 or $7 smoke detector in your house, there's just no reason for it. Just no reason for it. And while we're on that too, mm-hmm. Oftentimes people say, well, the smoke detector is annoying, it's always going off. You know, there are specific directions so that you don't put it in a place that's more prone to being activated. For instance, in the kitchen, where if you happen to burn something, although I have seen people set off a smoke detector on the other side of the house, because they've just had a bit of a problem in the cooking department. Mm-hmm. Once again, it's just a tragedy. Also, another thing that would be good to have for people would be carbon monoxide detectors. Certainly you can see smoke. You can't see it if you're sleeping and it will kill you, but carbon monoxide is a silent killer. And for the cost of, $10, $15, you can get a combination smoke detector and a carbon monoxide detector. And for those of you that aren't familiar with carbon monoxide, essentially carbon monoxide is produced from incomplete combustion. So for instance, your furnace, let's say your furnace is not adjusted properly and you're not getting complete combustion and you've got a leak in your exhaust system, that can permeate your residence and it starts to manifest symptoms such as headache, dizziness, all the way up to and including unconsciousness and death. Yeah. Once again, you can buy combination detectors. And for the people that say, well, geez, I can never get it straightened out. When do I change the batteries in a smoke detector? You don't even have to worry about that anymore. They make 10-year smoke detectors nowadays where you don't even mess with it. You put it up, the battery's good for 10 years, the smoke detector's good for 10 years. At the end of 10 years, you throw it away. So there really is no good reason why you should not have a smoke detector, for not only for your own safety, but any guests, your children. It's just a very, very, once again, it's a tragic circumstance when we've gone to fires and residences and people have perished. And we found that yes, indeed, they did have smoke detectors, but they'd been deactivated. Yeah, so it's really bad.
That is tragic. And on the smoke detector, on the carbon monoxide, I'm an anesthesiologist, so we talk a lot about that. That's the first part of my training, about carbon monoxide, because carbon monoxide basically blocks the hemoglobin from being able to carry the oxygen. And unfortunately, it's a silent killer. That's why if you run a vehicle inside a closed space, you can kill yourself. And the problem with it is it just makes you sleepy, and then you go to sleep and mm-hmm. you die. And so it's not unlike a fire that'll burn you up. It's painful. This is kind of it's actually a peaceful way to go, I think, but it's a terrible way to go, because the problem, it just puts you to sleep. So you've heard of people where, like you said, their furnaces were not functioning right, or there's a leak in it. So the carbon monoxide is getting pumped through the house. And so if there's no detector, you're sleeping, it puts you to sleep more, and that's it. They find your body the next day, kind of thing. So.
And you know, another tragic thing that we often see in cold weather climates is you never bring a barbecue in the house. Never bring a barbecue in the house. You'd be surprised how many people bring a barbecue in the house and cook with it, or have a generator. Recently, we had all the trees down. I'm sure there were quite a few people that were on generator power. You never keep a generator inside. You need to vent those exhaust gases, because just like your furnace can go ahead and put off carbon monoxide, an internal combustion engine produces the same thing. So once again, it's just one of those things that it's a tragedy. And the saddest part about it is a $10 detector could have solved it, and perhaps just better education. Those two components right there, once again, it's a tragedy when you go to someone's house, especially when you've seen a whole family that not necessarily has perished, but the fact that they're all ill. And you know, oftentimes these people have to get very, very specific treatments, such as a hyperbaric chamber.
Yeah.
And it's, once again, so easily avoided.
And you're absolutely right. Actually, a friend of ours that we know, they were renting a house and they kept getting headaches and just not feeling rested in the morning, and they're wondering what's going on. So they ended up getting carbon monoxide detector, that one that had the number. And that's what they found out. They had a leak in the furnace, and this had been going on for months. So thankfully it wasn't enough to kill them, but they were having symptoms. But again, that was a carbon monoxide detector that really saved them.
And then if I could just say one more thing about the carbon monoxide detector, is if you have a carbon monoxide detector and it does activate, don't think that it's just a false alarm. Please call 911. We have procedures in place. Every fire department has procedures in place where we'll respond. We'll go ahead and monitor the atmosphere. Oftentimes we'll have the utility company come in to back up what we found with their instrumentation, because we just want to be absolutely sure before we tell someone, now your house is clear, or you've got a significant problem. And if they have a significant problem, if they can't find a place to stay for the night with, say, relatives, we can certainly activate the Red Cross to assist them. So there is a way to deal with this, but please, the most important thing to come out is if your smoke detector activates, especially if your carbon monoxide detector activates, let us come on out, let us monitor the air for you. It's much better for us to do that than for us to come back the following morning and find that a tragedy's occurred.
That's a very good point.
Well, we've got to take a break now, but we'll be right back. We're back. This is Dr. Soren. I'm talking to Vern Roof, a veteran of the fire department, and we've been having a great conversation about safety.
At what point do you decide my fire extinguisher is not going to cut it and I need to get out? How do you make that call?
I would personally, and there's other variables involved, but if you've discharged a fire extinguisher at some type of fire and it has not gone out, I would make sure that 911 has been alerted, the fire department's on the way, everyone has exited. And once again, everybody needs to know their limitations. You need to know when it's time to leave. And unless you've got a high pressure water hose somewhere, once again, if an extinguisher hasn't taken care of it, and really it's surprising just how many fires in the United States are successfully extinguished. Simple act of putting a lid over the top of a pan. You know, there's simple things that you can do that we never hear about in the news, but there's a significant amount of these things that occur every year.
Yeah. Thank you. No, I'm coughing. That's a great point because, like a grease fire, I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, you want to put a lid on that. It's a very simple thing, but you know, you get a big flame. And it may be intimidating, but all you may have to do is just put a lid on it and that puts it out.
Yeah. And, you know, oftentimes people will say, well, throw water on it. No, that's not a good idea because you'll get that big flare up. Some people say throw a salt on it. You know, that goes back to that's probably not the best thing to do either. And what do people invariably do when something catches fire? What do? They blow on it. Oh. You're laughing. And you know what I'm talking about. You've seen it. I've done it myself where you have a fire and you try to blow it out. It's human nature. Yeah. That's probably not the best thing to do either, because if it's a grease fire, you could spread it, you know, now you've blown it across the top of the, range or cooktop.
Mm-hmm. And then where do you recommend to have fire extinguishers? And maybe you can touch on the ABC thing. What kind of where did you put your fire extinguishers?
You know, I would go ahead and I would have a minimum. Mm-hmm. I figure if I would get a extinguisher comparable to the one that we require most businesses to have, which would be a 2A, 10BC. 2A, 10BC. Okay. And that will take care of the majority of fires that you will have in your private residence. A lot of people will have these small fire extinguishers, but you know what? If I'm going to battle against a fire, I want to make sure that I have more than just enough to put it out. Because once again, if that fire extinguisher doesn't extinguish it, I'm leaving the residence. So I would much rather have a little more insurance. You're not talking about that much of a significant cost. Get a good fire extinguisher. Be careful. Some of them, some of the less expensive extinguishers, it's difficult to find a fire extinguishing company that will recharge them if they have a different type of top on them. So get a good extinguisher, have it in your house, and we always tell people mount it someplace where you don't have to go deep in your residence to find it. Perhaps put it next to an exit way so that, you know, you can access it. You can certainly have a change in thought or mind. Maybe I shouldn't fight this, and have it handy. Where are the majority of fires? Oftentimes in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. You know, that's
a little bit outside your kitchen because you don't want to go into the kitchen and grab it.
Yeah, I mean, I have mine, one in my garage, and then I have one downstairs. You know, once again, I think some people would say, that might be a little overkill, but I figure this, why not have one downstairs? That way I don't have to run upstairs to get the extinguisher. And I have one in the garage where if I have some type of issue in the garage, I can address that. And if I have a fire in the kitchen, it's kind of split halfway between. I've got good access for both points. Because really, statistically, that's where a lot of your fires will occur. Not to say that you can't have fires in bedrooms and living rooms, electrical issues, but an awful lot of fires occur in those two key points in your residence.
Okay, what are the two key points again? Kitchen
and the garages.
Garages.
And once again, I'm not saying that those are the only places you can have fires. I certainly wouldn't want somebody to say, well, geez, I've heard of a fire in my living room and in my laundry room. You can have a fire anywhere in your residence, but when you think of the possibilities and you think of what is in those rooms, you know, those have a fairly high incidence of...
As a kid, they used to do a Christmas tree burning thing every year. But they used to set up a little living room with a Christmas tree, and they would show you how fast that thing, a dried Christmas tree at the end of the season, how fast, you know, some of your lights that are not, you know, wires that are frayed or something could just, and they would set up a little living room, and it was very impressive how fast that thing would just go up in smoke.
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of heat, and unfortunately, not only do you have the Christmas tree burning, but anything that's in close contact with it is now burning. And very quickly, you go from a very small fire on a tinder dry Christmas tree, and now you have one full room that's on fire.
Let's talk a little bit about the outside of your home, especially out here in Northern Idaho. You have a lot of people with that live more rural and forests. What are some important safety things you should do? People have like fuel storage. What are some important things or principles to keep in mind for minimizing your risk of fire?
Well, you know, Idaho Department of Lands and a lot of the local fire departments have handouts that they'll give to people throughout the year, and especially around the wildland season, that tells you, you know, clear the pine needles off your roof, clear your gutters out, don't have firewood stacked up against the side of your building, make sure your chimney's been swept, make sure there's no flammable vegetation next to your residence. Make sure that you have a defensible space. More often than not, they're going to recommend, you know, 30 feet. 30 feet's a pretty good distance because, you know, we want to live in the forest. We don't want a clear cut around us. But once again, there are certain things that you can do, and the fire departments in the Bonner County, as well as the Idaho Department of Land, have some really, really good handouts. They have magnets to put on your refrigerators. And it's just a good reminder for you that when Mother Nature decides to throw us a curveball and, you know, wildland fires start, they're very, very difficult. We're kind of at the mercy of Mother Nature, the winds, the temperature. You know, I came from a city that had two very, very significant fires, and it was 100 degrees and the winds were 80 miles an hour. And it doesn't really matter how many firefighters you have there. When Mother Nature goes on a rampage, it's very, very difficult. And they actually, in talking with the guys who were on the fires, they said that really for about the first 24 to 36 hours, yes, they were doing some firefighting, but a lot of it was mainly evacuating people.
Yeah.
And I can see where that might very well be the case out here. We're in a perfect scenario. We're considered in a wildland urban interface area. Mm-hmm. We have wildland and then we have an urban interface. Pretty much just about every residence here in Bonner County, if you are not in the city proper, you're in a wildland urban interface. And the more you can do to triage your residence without doing a clear cut, without going overboard, it makes it safer for you so that when the fire department does go through, we can decide where we can make a stand. Can we make a stand at this house? And there are circumstances every year throughout the United States that fire departments have this all pre-planned, and they'll go through and they'll say, here's a winner, here's a loser, and they're going to devote the majority of the resources to the properties that can be saved.
Really? I haven't heard that. So that's interesting. So how do you make your property so the fire department quickly looks at it and says, this is a winner, we're going to try to save this place? What are the quick things? Because obviously you're making this decision on the fly very quickly.
Well, what I'm looking for, is there more than one entry in and out? Mm-hmm. You know, it's very dangerous at times for firefighters to go into a subdivision when there's only one road in and out. So we'll be taking a look at that. We're looking at how the people have prepared their residence. Are there trees within 5 feet? Is it low hanging? Do they have ladder fuels? What I mean by ladder fuels is something that a fire could climb, which would enable it to get up into the tops of the trees or up higher. We'd be taking a look at the topography involved. Is the person at the top of a hill? Fire will make a much quicker run normally. going uphill, it preheats the fuel in front of it. So oftentimes that's why you've heard the stories where the fire just raced right up the hill. Often if you're in a draw or a chimney, fire will progress up chimneys and draws much quicker.
Top of the hill with the beautiful view is nice, but from a fire perspective, it's bad, huh?
It could be bad, especially if you've never cut down and you've got 10-foot high grasses, you've never maintained any of the property, because the fire will move right up the hill. Once again, I think there's really a good happy medium between clear cutting, making it look like the Serengeti Desert, mm-hmm. and appreciating the fact that you live in North Idaho, and, you know, clearing back, you know, 30 to 40 feet, making sure that you don't have firewood stacked up, making sure your chimney's clear, making sure you've eliminated some of those ladder fuels, making sure that you've got good access for the fire department, make sure that your address numbers are posted. You know, all these are things that help the fire department should we be in this wildland type of, circumstance.
We got to take a break right now, but we'll switch gears and talk more about paramedic EMT and medical emergencies when we come back. We're back. Let's just pick up right where we were talking about smoke detectors. Any other locations we should have smoke detectors?
I think it's a good idea, and I actually have one in my residence. I have a smoke detector in my garage. Now, some people will say, why do you have it in the garage? When you think of everything that's in a garage, you've got a vehicle with probably, 30, 35 gallons of a highly flammable, explosive, volatile liquid. You've got pesticides, you've got oils, you've got batteries. And how do they position a garage in relation to a bedroom? Oftentimes, the garage is farthest away from the bedroom. There have been multiple circumstances where we've responded on garage fires where the people had no idea that their garage was even on fire. Neighbors called it in. So once again, $10, throw it in your garage. People are concerned that certainly if you have a real smoky diesel or you decide to vacuum out your garage, you might activate it. But once again, real cheap insurance. You know, if you're in bed one night and you hear your smoke detector going off in your garage, might not be a bad idea just to investigate it. I just wanted to throw that in there because, once again, having seen so many of those instances where people had no idea their house was on fire, that's pretty scary. And once again, a smoke detector will give you an opportunity and a chance. It will go off when the fire is relatively small still.
That's a great point. That's a very good point. And I know a lot of people have shops and things, so it might not be bad to have them there too. So let's talk a little bit about what should you do if you're in a fire, what to do, what not to do.
The most important thing about being in a fire is oftentimes everybody sees on in the movies that the firefighters go in and you can see everything. Realistically, when you go into a fire, more often than not, we're unable to see anything. Now, the technology has allowed us to see through the smoke. We now have been carrying thermal imaging cameras where we can go ahead and go into the residences, and it helps us seek out not only victims, but the source of the fire. But if you envision putting a black cloth over your face, that is what your average firefighter will see when they go into a residential or a commercial structure fire. When you think of what's burning in there, you've got plastics, hydrocarbons, you know, you've got a lot of things that are putting off some very, very dense smoke. There's some great YouTube channels where sometimes we can see, other times it's pitch black. So if you happen to find yourself sleeping one night in your bedroom and your smoke detector goes off, a lot of people will advocate having a smoke detector in every room. Some people just will not go that route. Some will advocate sleeping with your doors closed. I sleep with my doors closed. I have plenty of smoke detectors. If I hear the smoke detector go off, remember, the lower you can get, the better. Mm-hmm. When you think of it, where does all the heat go? It goes upwards.
Right.
You can tell that by, you know, that's the way, if you take a look at a candle flame, where's the heat going? It's going up into the air. That's the same thing if something's burning. It's going to be in the upper levels of your residence. So try to get down to the floor. Crawl along the floor if you can. Certainly, if you have to open a door, feel the door before you open it. People will tell you, feel it with the back of your hand. Why do you feel it with the back of your hand? Because your back of your hand is more sensitive than the front. Mm-hmm. If you smell something, if you hear something, these are all things that you should be very cognizant of and have some type of plan. More than likely, most of us know the exact layout of our residence. But if you go to a hotel, if you're going to someone's residence you're not familiar with, they may think you're a little bit paranoid, but just familiarize yourself with how you can get out of that residence should there be an emergency. Just simple things that you can do. And certainly if you go to a hotel, they have all those really nice drawings and schematics showing exit ways, and they've gotten much more, safety oriented by putting exit lighting down on the floor. For the longest time, where did they always have exit lighting?
The top.
Yeah. But we're telling people to crawl along the floor. How would somebody know where the exit was? So more and more places you're seeing, for instance, on, you know, airplanes have it on the floor because they want people to crawl. If you go to movie theaters, you've got those lights on the floor. So I think we've made lots of good strides, but once again, it's just being cognizant of your surroundings, having confidence that you can get out, and just knowing full well that maybe the best thing for you to do at times is hunker down, shove some towels under the door if you've got smoke coming out. Maybe you have a window that you can exit. We spoke earlier about some people have these collapsible rope ladders they can throw out a window. Some people will drop just a regular rope down. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm trying to say is just have some kind of plan for you. Dial 911 as quickly as you can. And then once you do exit the residence, they'll always tell you to have some type of plan for the family so that one person does an exit to the front yard, one to the backyard, one to the side yard. If that's the only way to get out, great. But at least meet somewhere so when fire and EMS show up, you can tell the firefighter or the EMS person that comes up to you, hey, we're all out and we're all accounted for, so that someone unnecessarily does not go into a search when somebody has already been exited.
You're right. And I could see if there was a mom and the kids climbed out the back and they were somewhere else, I could see if, you know, like a mother or father just rushing into a fire and the kid might be outside. So if you all have a meeting place, then you would know not to risk your life in doing that. That's a great plan. Those are actually very good things. We all get lazy. You go into a hotel, you see all those signs everywhere of exits, and maybe you make a note to yourself about it. You know, on the airplane, they always say, you know, look at where the nearest exit is near you, right? So we all kind of like ignore those things, but those are very important. Like I said, that's all useless info until you need it. Yeah. So those are very, very good hints. Some of those I hadn't thought of as much, especially when you go to somebody else's house. And emphasizing the importance of having a meeting spot where if there's a fire, this is where we meet. I think that's a great point. So then you can clearly identify who's out and who's not. I get kind of a, maybe this is a silly question, but it's not, but you know, some people will risk their lives for a pet. So I'd heard, you know, of a story recently where somebody was in a fire. He got out, he was at home by himself, but he closed the two dogs in the house. So he told me his dogs died. Any thoughts on pets? Going in for pets or what you can do? Will a pet naturally want to get out of there? I don't know.
Well, you know, the animals sometimes are very scared. I mean, if they're hearing a smoke detector going off, there's smoke in the air, you may be yelling, they may be hearing things. Who knows, they may just beat feet and try to hide somewhere, you know, a cat, a dog. We always encourage people, please, if you've safely exited the building, do not go back in for any reason. There are so many instances of people safely making it out, but realizing that a pet has been left in there or a personal belonging. Certainly I can understand, you know, someone going back in to try to save a loved one, a child or an adult, perhaps someone who is, you know, unable to exit by themselves. For instance, maybe they're in a wheelchair or a walker. But once again, that's another big tragedy that occurs all the time. If you've safely made it out, everything can be replaced in that residence. Yes, I know that there's family heirlooms, there's pictures, there's things that mean a lot to you, but please, if you exit, do not go back in. And one other thing, if I could add, you know, if you know that the fire perhaps is confined to one bedroom or one room, on your way out, notice I say on your way out, close the door. Oftentimes people, they will exit the residence without taking that simple procedure. And that literally can mean confining that fire to one bedroom or two bedrooms versus it spreading throughout the entire residence by the time the fire department gets there.
That's a very, very good point, because people forget, my understanding is if you open a door, especially a window to the outside, that can just suck air in and that'll bring the fire towards that area. So you want to leave the door closed or even put a towel underneath it if you're stuck in that room to minimize the airflow into that room, correct?
Yeah, you have to be very careful, because what does fire need to burn? It needs lots of oxygen. And if all of a sudden you inadvertently introduce quite a bit of oxygen to a fire that perhaps isn't burning as well as it could, now you've got a fire that's raging out of control. And once again, just the simple steps of emergency drills, knowing what to do, not panicking. Hey, if you're on your way out, close the door. Make sure, and this is a big one, make sure you've dialed 911. Yeah, like you had mentioned in the beginning, oftentimes when you get a big cluster of people, everybody thinks, oh, somebody else is calling. Mm-hmm. And realize too that in the paradise we live in North Idaho, for those of you that live in the city limits, certainly you're going to get a quicker response. You're going to have more firefighters at your house, but the farther you live away from a population center, it's going to take us longer to get there. And that's why it becomes vitally important to have these plans in place, to recognize, please, if you want to try to attempt to put the fire out, make sure you call 911 before you do that.
Well, we've got to take a break now, but we'll be right back. We're back. We're talking to Vern Roof, a Northside fire commissioner and a longtime fire department veteran. So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about the health aspect, the EMT aspect of firefighting.
You initially, what got you interested in this, there was a show called Emergency. I think I vaguely remember that show as a kid.
Yeah, I don't know how many of the viewers will recognize that, but it was probably in the mid-70s. It was filmed in LA County. Uh-huh. And, that pretty much really started the fire departments taking a look and becoming more and more involved in emergency medical services. And it hasn't stopped since then.
Yeah. And my understanding is, especially in some of these urban areas, because of all the new codes, there's a lot less fires. And so EMS firefighters mm-hmm. end up doing a lot of medical things. So let's talk just real quick on what are some things that maybe you should have inside your car or in a quick kit? What are some important things that maybe people haven't thought of?
We spoke about it earlier, that tourniquet. A tourniquet's not a bad idea. And I just want to be caution people that everyone needs to know their limitations, certifications, and certainly we don't want people practicing medicine out there. So we wouldn't want somebody carrying a top flight, medical bag with things they may or may not be approved, or they may or may not be able to utilize properly. But just a simple basic first aid kit, certainly in this time of COVID, communicable diseases, etc., for sure have some gloves, have some eye protection, have some gloves that should you run across a vehicle accident, you're not going to commingle someone else's blood with yours. A couple pairs of gloves, eye protection, some bandaging material. A tourniquet's not a bad idea. A tourniquet literally could save someone's life. It's been proven time and time again during the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. There's soldiers walking around right now because either they put on a tourniquet or their buddies put tourniquets on them. I have a mask should I have to perform mouth-to-mouth on someone. It's a disposable mask. It has a one-way valve in it, so there's no chance of me getting any type of, should they vomit or should there be some type of release of fluids from their mouth, I would not, get it into my mouth. Trying to think of some other things. Bandages, we talked about that. Take the worst case scenario where time is of the essence, and I would think being able to take care of someone's airway, stop bleeding. Those are some of the big ones that literally could mean someone's life before emergency medical services and the fire department can get there.
Yeah, and the tourniquet thing, I just want to emphasize that. They make these tourniquets that have a Velcro strap and then little metal device that you can really cinch it down. Mm-hmm. And I think they're about $15-$20, maybe even less. But I know I've got a couple of those. So if you have extremity bleeding, because I've heard of people on a fishing charter where, you know, I forgot what fish they caught, but an aggressive one, it bit somebody's femoral and they bled to death, you know, because mm-hmm. nobody on the ship, you know, knew what to do. And so a guy ends up bleeding to death out on a commercial fishing charter. So those types of things are like applying pressure, knowing how to use a tourniquet. You know, I remind people, you've got about 5 liters of blood in your body, which isn't that much. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of those 2-liter mm-hmm. Soda bottles. So you've got about 2.5 of those. And once that goes out, once you lose about 1 soda bottle, you're pretty much done. So it doesn't take that much bleeding to have a very serious injury. So that's super, super important.
You know, another thing, Doc, that somebody can carry, a blanket. You know, whether you buy one of those rescue blankets, you can buy them at, you know, Army surplus stores or, you know, medical stores. It's, you know, the yellow highway blanket, disposable, or carry a blanket in your car. If someone's going into shock, just the mere fact that you can cover them, you can keep them warm. That's a big deal right there. And also for those of you that may not want to carry a kit, may not feel comfortable with utilizing some type of, you know, emergency medical technique or, you know, instrument. Hey, just the mere fact that if you stop at an accident, sometimes just holding somebody's hand, sometimes reassuring them that helps on the way, you know, carrying on a conversation with them that they don't, so they don't feel that they're alone. Mm-hmm. They're going through probably the worst day of their life right at this very point. And just the fact that you thought enough to stop, oftentimes you can keep someone's spirits at least up until, you know, the professionals get there and then they can take over. And certainly I would advocate that if you've been there ever since the start of an accident, because you witnessed it, the paramedics and the firefighters and EMS, they will listen to you. You know, please feel free to let them know what happened. You know, that was the person unconscious? Was the person walking around before they got there? We are always eager, because you are our eyes and ears before we get there. So please, just because we show up, please don't disappear. Give us any information that you might have, because literally it could really make an impact on the continued care of the patient.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Let's just talk briefly about leadership, because we talked about that and there's been lots of cases. It's written up in psychology books. When there's a lot of people and something happens, there's always a feeling like, well, somebody else is gonna do something, so I'm just gonna sit here and watch. And so you see situations where nobody does anything. Any thoughts on leadership or taking leadership, what to do, what not to do?
Well, when you think of, if everybody just thinks about a circumstance or a news event that they've seen where just an ordinary person has risen to the occasion and taken control of a circumstance, they may not be a paramedic, they may not be a firefighter, they may not even have had any aspirations to be involved in emergency medical services, but because of an unusual circumstance, they've risen to the occasion and they've become that leader. We all have it in us. And should you find yourself in that position, there usually is someone that will step up and will take some type of command. And what I would recommend is, if you come across one of those circumstances and you happen to be in that position and you tell someone, hey, go dial 911, be sure to tell them and please come back. Probably at that point in time, you don't hear an awful lot of please and thank yous, but hey, go dial 911, let me know that you've done it by coming back and reporting to me. You may have someone safely try to control traffic. You may have someone safely try to, you know, find out some information about the patient. There are some fairly significant things. And once again, just the mere fact that someone has stopped to render assistance, and even if no medical care occurs, just the fact that you can lend someone the confidence and the reassurance that, hey, I'm with you, I'll stay with you until, you know, the professionals get here, that goes a very, very long way.
Well, we're about out of time. So, Vern, thank you so much for the interview. If you want to see the full video interview that I did, you can go to my YouTube channel, Dr. Soren MD. So that's DrSorinMD on YouTube. And I've been posting these radio interviews we've been doing there. Vern, again, thank you so much. I learned a lot. You've given us a lot of great things to think about and things to be prepared for.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, that's all the time we have. This is Dr. Soren, and I'm usually on the third Monday of every month. Thank you so much for joining us today. Have a great week, everyone.